Welcome to the Comics Coffee Metal Podcast, episode 129.
Greetings and welcome to the Comics Coffee Metal Podcast. I'm your host, Don Cardenas, and I hope you've been having a pretty good 2024. Because it feels like it's been since 2023 since I've sat down here and just talked about some recommendations and things that have been going on with, everything Comics Coffee Metal Land. And yeah, it's been quite a year so far for us. Between passing the baton of sickness between everybody to, trying to do two books at the same time, not alternating, on top of getting some music done and getting podcasts done and trying to prep for a convention and all of that stuff. It's been pure madness around here, and it's not going to let up anytime soon. So let me do some general news and house cleaning and some recommendations, and we'll get to our awesome interview with Phil Hester. First and foremost, just general Comics Coffee Metal Land news. I am currently knee-deep in both the inks for Eevee and the Helsings issue 3 and Spend the Night issue 5. Both of those are moving concurrently together, and I didn't plan it this way. It just kind of ended up being this way. I was, I guess, wrongfully assuming that I would have a little bit of a break from Spend the Night as we get ready to release the trade paperback edition of the first four issues, and it would have a little bit of gap, but nope, no rest for the wicked here. We're just going to keep grinding through, which is fine. You know, I'm eager to get more stuff out there, and happy to do it. It's just, yeah, it's just coming a little sooner than I thought, so I was kind of not expecting me carrying that load as well, but here we are. I'm going to do it, and so far everything's been looking great, so I can't really complain. Along with that, Eevee and the Helsings 3 is also progressing, and I'm really, really, really excited for everyone to see this issue. After the cliffhanger drop of the second issue, it's a little bit more of a character-driven thing. We get a little bit more of the history of the Van Helsings, and we get a training montage, and I love a good training montage, so I hope you do as well. It's been a lot of fun to draw and plan out, and I'm really looking forward to finishing this issue and getting the fourth issue rolling too, because that'll conclude this first arc, and I think a lot of people are really going to enjoy it. On top of that, I think the podcast has started off pretty dang strong this year. I've had a lot of great interviews from Scott Brian Wilson to Nelson Blake to Shadi Amin to Dave Jordan and to now Phil Hester. It's been just, I think, banger after banger of people. And it's been really awesome. And I got a lot more really, really awesome ones planned up in front of us. And yeah, I think if you've missed any of those episodes, please go back and check them out. Those are all awesome people. And if you have any interest in comics, coffee, and metal, there's something great in each one of those episodes for you. On top of that, I re-released a song. I put out the song Dead Eyes a couple years ago via Bandcamp, and I was proud of it then and still proud of it now. Listening back, there's a lot of not great mixing and kind of stuff happening. So in the spirit of 2024, me putting out a lot more music, I went and I retracked a bunch of the guitars, I remixed everything, and I think it came out even better. And now that I am putting things out through DistroKid, it is now out on all of the streaming services, Apple, Spotify, YouTube Music, all that stuff. So it's been a lot easier to get it out to more people that way. And I'm just even more proud of this song now as it was then. It's a song that means a lot to me. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to wrapping up a few more songs and getting those out before the first half of the year is up. On top of that, my buddy Kevin Mellon and I, we have finally put the finishing touches on our first original song together. And I think it came out great. Kevin did the mixing for that one. And once it's ready to drop and be released, I'll be, just screaming from the rooftops about it. And we're also jumping right back in and getting some more original tunes done between us. And hopefully before long, we'll be able to announce the project and all that stuff. But 2024 is looking like I'm keeping that promise of getting music out, and I'm really, really excited for it. On top of that, I have also been kind of, not secretly, but like slowly putting together a few more covers and things like that, because I want to put out some more cover songs, you know, metalize a few more things, and or just do different takes of different kind of heavier songs, maybe bring them to a different subgenre of metal and stuff, and start incorporating that into some more time-lapse art videos and stuff like that, like I was doing a few years ago. So those are slowly being put together on top of everything else. And then last but not least, I have a table at C2E2 for the first time in the, I think, roughly 8 or 9 times I've been to the show, and maybe like the 5 or 6 I've actually tabled. This is the first time I got in first round, which is great. Still extremely nerve-wracking, but it's nice to know I have a table waiting for me for the show. It's at the very end of April, so we're still about 2 months away. I have my commissions are open currently. If you want to hear any more about that, I'll make sure there's a link in the show notes to the details for commissions, for, you know, buying them to pick up at the show, or I'll ship them to you. Either way, commissions are a great way to help creators kind of get closer to breaking even before we step foot in the convention center. It takes a lot of pressure off. So if it's not me you're interested in terms of art-wise, go find one of your favorite creators who's going to be at a show you're attending, and see if they got open commissions, and see if you can pick up one of those, because the less we have to worry about the cost of the show as we walk into the show, it's just a lot of stress off of our backs. And I know as a fan myself that the cost to attend the show as a fan is getting greater and greater every year as well, and it's just expensive everywhere. So, you know, I get it, everything's expensive, but if you're able to, you know, that is one of the absolute best ways to support creators like myself and my friends. And yeah, it's just one of those things where it's like, you know, we're kind of customers of the convention too, you know, buying the Artist Alley tables, you know, those things at C2E2 are almost $500. And then you want to factor in, you know, got to pay for parking all 3 days. And I'm local pretty much, so I'll be driving in every morning, and I'm still going to be out like almost $1,000 in expenses for this. So I can't imagine what some of the people who are flying in or having to put up with lodging and stuff, you know, what their buy-in cost is for all this. So that's kind of why I'm bringing it all up. But still, it's a great show. It's always fun to see, you know, all my friends there, and just, you know, fellow fans, and just people coming by and saying hi. It's definitely worth it for the social aspect of it. But yeah, you know, if you're interested in getting a commission, I certainly would appreciate it. besides that, I think that covers it with all the latest updates for myself and for Comics Coffee Metal. So from that, let's get into some really quick recommendations and then off to our interview. All right, first up is my comic book recommendation, and that is, and I apologize if I brought this up last time I brought up recommendations, but since then I've read the second and third issues and it's just gotten better and better, and that is Skeeters from Mad Cave Studios, written by Bob France and Kevin Cuff, drawn by who else? The amazing and ultra talented friend of the show, friend to me, Kelly Williams. Skeeters is about the town of Kankakee, Virginia, where outside this sleepy, swampy, kind of stereotypical southern town is a facility that's getting into some pretty gnarly biological shit. And before too long, there's giant mosquitoes rampaging through the town, killing people and the most gnarly of ways, and everyone's figuring out what's going on, how do we survive this. And it is got the best vibes to it whatsoever. You know, if you toss on a John Carpenter Lost Themes album and read this book, and there's no better setting for that. Kelly's artwork is just perfectly suited for this. His, you know, awesome, you know, stylized character expressions and just, you know, very lush line work combined with the just really gnarly deep watercolors he uses. And I've been reading PDFs, and I don't know if this comes through on the printing, but on the PDFs, I really appreciate how they just kind of let the details of Kelly's work show. You know, you can see some of the brushwork. You can see, you know, it's not overly saturated. It's not cleaned up, so to speak. Not that it needs to be cleaned up, but you know what I mean. It's not, there's no sheen put on it. It's got, you see the work that Kelly's putting on in here, and it adds so much to this vibe. It's kind of like, you know, it might just be in my head or the vibes of it, but it's kind of like I'm reading a VHS comic almost, because there's just something about seeing, you know, almost the texture of the paper come through. It's kind of like the scan lines of a VCR or something like that. And it just adds so much to the vibe of the book. And I love it dearly. It is really, really awesome. Of course, you know, Kevin, Bob, Kelly, they're my buds, but it's not my fault they're really talented. Sorry. You know, I think if you're not reading this book, you're heavily missing out. Especially if you like horror independent comics, if you like, you know, splatter gore 80s movies, this is it. There's no other comic made for you than this. So please check it out. Skeeters from Mad Cave. I'll make sure it's linked to the show notes below. You got 3 issues, man. Just dive right in. You're going to love it. I guarantee it. All right, my next recommendation is coffee. This is not so much a recommendation that I'm putting forth wholeheartedly, but your mileage may vary, but I feel it's worth bringing up. So in, you know, almost one of the most spot-on themes of the show, this coffee company is called Happy, and it is co-owned by Robert Downey Jr. Yes, Mr. Iron Man. Has his own coffee company now, and it's called Happy. And, you know, I was interested in it just because, you know, hey, it's very thematic to the show. I'm always down to try new coffees. Let's check it out. And on top of them having a component where they're donating to the National Rainforest Alliance, which, awesome, great, they had a lot of K-cups. And over the Christmas time, we acquired one of those smaller K-cup brewers. And I was like, you know what? I have never had a good cup of coffee from a K-cup, you know, and because we got it mostly for my wife. She likes the flavored drinks and stuff like that from those. And so I'm like, you know what? Let's try it out. You know, so I tried their light roast, Extraordinary, I believe it's called, and their Miraculous Medium Roast. And I was not impressed by either one. But they weren't bad. And I kid you not, where like I've had probably well over a dozen different kind of cups of coffee from a K-cup brewer, different brands, whatever, and I've never had a good one. I've never had one that I liked. This was fine. So that's why I'm kind of recommending it, because I would think, like, on the scale of things, like, if you like coffee that's coming from K-cups and we kind of align in our taste a little bit from general coffee, like, maybe this will be an amazing cup of coffee for you. I've had it a few times after my first initial kind of underwhelming reaction, and each time, you know, I'm kind of figuring out the formulation of things, you know, how much water, yada yada yada, but each time, you know, it's done the job. You know, I didn't, like, sit here drinking it like, this is miserable, I'm just drinking it because I need coffee. But I'm not sitting here thinking, like, oh man, I really need a cup of that coffee. So it's definitely good to have around. It comes in handy. But again, your mileage may vary, but I thought it was worth bringing up. I think the light roast works a lot better than the medium roast. I've come across this thing lately where I'm buying more medium roasts, but they keep getting, like, darker and darker. And I'm not a fan of that. Like, I like a dark roast, but if I'm buying a medium roast, that shit better be medium. You know what I mean? I recently tried the Leo's Oakland Coffee, the Green Day, their coffee company or whatever, and their medium roast was dark as shit, and that was really disappointing because that's not what I was buying into it. You know, so not to say that, you know, it was bad as a general coffee, but again, if you're going to be the thing, say you're the thing. So, you know, but that's aside, you know, this feels kind of silly. I'm kind of ranting about it, but I'm also recommending it because I'm still drinking it. And when I run out, I'll probably order some more. It's good to have around in a pinch. And, you know, I think it's worth at least saying, you know what, check it out for yourself and make your decision as opposed to just saying no, avoid at all costs. So, yeah, Happy Coffee. It's available at Target, and I bought it online. I had like a discount code or something, but you know, it's available in a lot of places. And if you get a chance to check it out, go ahead, check it out and let me know what you think. All right. Time for my music recommendations. Yes, I said plural. They're going to be quick. I'm not going to have sound clips. I'm not going to have time to edit those in right now, but hopefully you'll get the gist of what I'm saying. They're about from my descriptions here. So first and foremost is not a new album. It came out, I believe, in November of last year, and that is Invisible Signs from Mangini. Now, if that name sounds familiar to you, Mangini, yes, that is the former drummer of Dream Theater, who recently was released, let go, when original drummer Mike Portnoy came back to Dream Theater, and apparently at some point he had written a solo album with vocals by Jen Majura, who I'm only aware of as a guitar player who played in Evanescence for a few years on top of many other projects and her own solo projects. And this album also contains solos from, you know, Gus G of, you know, Ozzy and Firewind. And it's a really, really solid metal album. And I was really pleasantly surprised with it. I was unfamiliar with Jen as a vocalist, and she does a fantastic job. Mike's an amazing drummer. And what I think I like most about this album is, even though it's technically like a drummer's band, it's not like, you know, he's the star of the show. This, you know, he's definitely got his moments, but everyone gets their moments in this album. And the riffs and the guitar work and the solos, all top-notch stuff. And it's just an impeccably solid album. And I think it kind of has flown under the radar a bit, because I don't really see anyone talking about it. And I see people talking more about the fact he's not in Dream Theater anymore than this album, which is kind of shocking to me. Because again, it is a really, really great album. You know, songs like Freak of Nature, Invisible Signs, they kick off the album, and they're just really, really, really great starters. And they give you a good, solid impression of what to expect. And it's just a lot of solid, really solid songwriting. And, you know, I like living in the albums that are just really solid, you know. Granted, there's always standout albums that have like nonstop just classics front to back, but there's definitely an art in making something that's just, it's just good. You put it on, you leave it on, and it's just good, you know. And I think that's kind of underrated these days. So if you like some just, you know, straightforward kind of modern metal, really well done, definitely check it out. Mangini, Invisible Signs. My second recommendation is probably one that might be a little controversial to some people. I kind of talked about it a bit in my interview with Dave Jordan a couple episodes ago, and that is Project Regeneration Volume 2 from Static X. Now, this is the second volume of songs that they've put together from old demos and unreleased stuff from Wayne Static. I don't know if there's additional vocals performed by Zero, their new frontman, or if this was all Wayne's voice, because Zero does a great job of matching Wayne in a lot of ways. But, you know, it's kind of given me a, you know, I for someone who might be familiar, I'll do a quick history. Static X is a, you know, industrial, self-proclaimed evil metal band. Evil disco was the type of music they said they did. That came out in the early 2000s. You know, they had their issues, and they kind of parted ways between Wayne Static and their bass player Tony Campos, who kind of jointly owned the name Static X. And they were a bit contentious between each other. And unfortunately, Wayne passed away due to heart failure, most likely due to, you know, addictions and things he was struggling with. And a few years ago, I believe in 2020, they decided to kind of reform and kind of start, you know, putting together stuff that was never finished and all that. And they brought their friend who they dubbed Zero, wearing a Wayne Static kind of death mask thing as kind of like a robot frontman type thing. And Zero was actually Edsel Dope from the band Dope, and they were all good friends. And through the blessing of Wayne's family and all that, they've kind of been touring as Static X. And from what I've seen from videos and from a lot of fans, like, it was very controversial when it came out, when it was first announced. But I think, you know, even like a few years in now of doing this, they're still very reverential to Wayne's legacy and things like that. And, you know, they're still very insistent that no one's going to replace him and things like that. So I think if you're going to do something like this, they've done it the best they possibly could. Again, your taste may vary, like a band going around touring with someone wearing essentially the face of their deceased singer. It might be in very bad taste, but with metal bands, like, it's kind of cool. I was definitely very much on the fence myself about it, but again, I've watched live videos, I've read plenty of interviews, and I've come around to the fact that they're just trying to, you know, the band belonged to all of them as well, and they're doing their best to just kind of like preserve the legacy of the band and go forth. Now, what they do after this, I don't know. I don't know if they're doing new music or whatever after this, but this Project Regeneration Volume 2 is supposedly the last of the Wayne stuff they had, and it's really good. I mean, this band was always at its best when it had these original members in it, Tony Campos, Koichi Fukada, and I'm forgetting the drummer's name, sorry, apologies, and Wayne Static, and all of them put back together, even with Wayne being gone, but, you know, his music and riffs and vocals still being there, all of them working on it together, it sounds like Static X. It's really, really great stuff. I was a fan of them from the beginning, kind of fell away from them in the later 2000s, as they kind of like changed their sound a bit. But now that they're kind of back more into that earlier sound, it's just, yeah, I think it's just a good return to form or a good send off. The opening track, Stay Alive, and one of the closer end tracks, the Disco Atsigo, because they always had like an Atsigo song on their albums for the most part. All just great stuff. And if you ever liked Static X at some point, I think you're going to like this album. I think you give it a shot. I've gone on way too long about this anyway, but yeah, I think that I've been listening to that a bunch. It's really, really great. And on top of that, you know, I've also been really still into my previous guest, Nelson Blake's band, Locked in a Vacancy, their Before the Dawn EP. It's still living in my rotation. It's just a great, great metal, hardcore-y type EP, and you know, you're not gonna be disappointed if that's kind of your bag and you want to check this out. So, just a quick recap: Invisible Signs, Mangini, solid metal, modern metal stuff. Before the Dawn EP from Locked in a Vacancy, really great metalcore, metal thrashy kind of stuff. And Project Regeneration Volume 2 from Static X. If you liked Static X before, you'll like this. Can you tell I'm out of practice from doing these things? I'm just rambly as hell right now, but that's what I got. I promise next time we'll be better. Next time we'll be much better. And today's guest is someone I've been wanting to have since essentially day one. But as things like this go, it's taken forever for me to either feel confident enough to ask that he'll come on, or just, you know, making the concerted effort to make sure I get all the people I really want to sit down and have a conversation with on. But, you know, regardless to say, this gentleman's work is long and storied, from DC to Marvel to Image to creator-owned work. You know his work. You know who this is. Phil Hester, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Hey, Don. Thanks for having me. I saw those guitars behind you. I thought you were going to, like, blame me on.
I should.
I thought you had, devised a riff just for me.
Maybe I will. I will make things more complicated for myself whenever I can. So,
yeah.
Maybe that's a new thing. I'll make a custom riff for everybody.
Yeah, that's a great... Lord, see? I've already made this whole interview worthwhile with my
exactly
insights.
But yeah, like I said, Phil, like you're one of the first pros I ever got to know online. And, you know, thankfully, I still know you.
Yeah.
And I haven't scared you off at all. But it's, you know, from the few times we've met at C2E2, you know, I've just been wanting to have like just sit down with you and have a nice long conversation, because, you know, you've done so much work that I've enjoyed and that so many other people have enjoyed. And you also have this just intense passion for comics still. And even though, you know, we disagree with your assessment of your skills, we all look up to you. We all think that, you know, you're killing it. You're all, you know, I, you know, have Kingdom of Monsters here, the collection here.
Oh, wow. Yeah, some, I see that.
Issues of that. It's, you draw one of my favorite Anguiruses. I mean, you know, he's my, you know, my favorite, like, non main kaiju.
Right.
So, you know, I was pleased to see that, you know, one of my favorite pros have drew one of my favorite kaiju, you know, in one of my favorite ways, because it can go a thousand different ways with the way some people draw Godzilla and his friends. But yeah, so
it was a fun gig.
I've already lost the plot here.
Yeah.
But yeah, I want to talk to you about so many things, you know, like your art collection and just even like your approach now and all that. But first things first, Comics Coffee Metal, what are you digging right now?
Well, we talked a little bit ahead of time about how I don't drink coffee. So, yes.
but you are a soda enjoyer, and I am very much a soda enjoyer. So what's your poison these days?
I'm so pathetic. I'm down to like, well, I had like a heart event like 8 years ago now. And I had a day when a doctor said, "You're done with salt, sugar, and caffeine. Like, those are not part of your life anymore." So yeah. I wasn't like one of those people that drank like Monster Energies all day or anything.
Yeah.
But I was drinking Diet Coke all day, you know, and so I had to scale back. So now I'm down to like Diet Orange Soda, which is pathetic. But I'm like chemically Mormon at this point in my life. But occasionally I will still enjoy like an Earl Grey, like a good, really like extra bergamot kind of Earl Grey is like
okay
my hot drink okay. of choice.
When it comes to soda, like I'm a diet soda person myself too, and not because I'm like I feel like it's any more beneficial to me health wise. I just like
it is
more.
It is.
I mean, no matter what they say,
my wife was talking about how bad fake sugar is, and it is. It's bad,
yeah.
But real sugar is way worse.
Yeah. And, you know, one of my favorite sodas actually is caffeine-free Diet Pepsi. So I have this thing that, like, if, you know, the doctor is ever like, you know, you got to cut your caffeine, I'm like, well, at least I know I got that.
Yeah, that's your, like, safety net.
Yeah, and that's something I've always, like, liked, because my grandma, when she was alive and she lived with us, when I was younger, that's the soda she got. So whenever we were out of our sodas, I would sneak down,
sneak grandma's,
sneak to her place, and then like just steal a couple of hers. And then I developed the taste for it. But yeah, I'm definitely a soda appreciator. I was the guy, you know, popping a Diet Pepsi at 7 in the morning. That was my coffee.
Yeah.
You know, and
I was in the same boat.
And my lovely wife, she could not handle it. She's like, I can't with you drinking sodas early. Like, she got it. It's just like for something with her, like that just didn't work for her. I'm like, okay. Then of course I'm like, I probably shouldn't be drinking soda at 7 o'clock in the morning. So then I switched to tea, and then it wasn't until like, you know, my mid-20s, I had finally had a coffee I liked, and then that's all she wrote. So
yeah. People that are into it are really into it.
Yeah. You know, I try to skirt the line, because I definitely have a tendency to, you know, get my special interest and like just dive way too into it and just burn out. So I try to keep a healthy relationship with it. We recently got a Keurig. I bought her one for my wife for Christmas. They had a cheap one, those little mini ones. And right now I'm drinking the Robert Downey Jr. brand Happy coffee. And
oh, okay.
You know, I've never had a good cup of coffee from a Keurig, and that still stands. This is okay.
But can you get an okay
one? It's okay. It's okay. It's working in the pinch. As I mentioned to Phil earlier before we started recording, I didn't have great night's sleep. I'm kind of dealing with the after effects of getting my COVID booster, which I don't regret getting, but it always kicks my ass. But I needed a little extra boost just to make sure I'm as alert as possible. But so you know, I came around the coffee, but I easily fall into just being a soda guy. You know, it's really easy. I've been trying to like do more seltzers, and I can do certain seltzers. There's one that comes in a bottle called Topo Chico.
Oh yeah, that's good.
The lime one is just, the problem is though, it keeps getting like out of stock in our area.
Yeah.
And so it's like, if they just had that in stock all the time, I wouldn't worry about buying any of the sodas. I would just get that. But anyway, so, you know, Metal, you were kind of telling me before we started recording that, you know, when you're coming up and you're a teenager, it was all the hair metal. It was all, you know, sure, like thrash and all that was around, but hair metal and glam metal, that was the big thing. And then
it was like Van Halen, Def Leppard kind of era. Mm-hmm. And I don't I don't want to disparage any of that music, but like,
no,
I was very like anti-establishment when I was a teenager. And like, even like AC/DC was the establishment, like when I was in high school. So I was eager to hear anything else. And like at the time, Judas Priest was sort of like the last bastion of like metal. And I was into them. And that's when they had probably their biggest hit. And when they had their Screaming for Vengeance album. And like, and also that album cover really spoke to me. As a comic book artist.
Yeah, and, it is probably one of the best album covers.
It's so awesome. Time, sure. Like, it's pure, like, it's like they saw into the psyche of like a 15-year-old boy.
for sure.
And that's like the first concert I ever went to. And it's like the most metal thing I ever did. We totaled a car on the way to that concert. Got out of the total concert. Car. And got another ride and made it to the concert anyway.
Oh, geez.
Not from any sort of chemical thing. We were just bad drivers because we were like 15. But and then so like after that, like when I was in college, it like Metallica wasn't really a thing yet. Like it was sort of a fallow period for metal, and industrial sort of filled that niche. You know, so I was really into like bands like Ministry or Skinny Puppy or Front 242, you know, just like that and kind of industrial, heavier sound.
Yeah.
And that sort of filled that gap for me for a time. And now it's just sort of like if I hear something and I think it's cool, like if I hear Coheed and Cambria and I like Coheed and Cambria, and like, that's like the only thing I really can't like truck with is the Cookie Monster stuff. That's like the closest I can get to that is High on Fire, you know. That's
okay.
You know, that's as close as I get to like non-melodic singing that I can hack.
Okay.
And that's, I mean, it's when you come up on Judas Priest, like Halford's like the best singer ever in metal.
Everything else is just a
you want singing comparison. You know, so
Yeah.
So that's sort of where I stand with metal. But like I said, I'm a 57-year-old man. So like I have to stumble on things to be, you know, into them. Like it's like we were talking before, the metal community is so like balkanized into their own camps. You know, like you'll have like, oh, you're into like Icelandic sludge metal? Well, I'm into Swedish metal. You know, like that's not real, you know. And I just sort of take what comes and, I can find something to like about, you know, most genres, and that includes metal.
Yeah. It's definitely one of the things I love about doing this show is because whenever I do talk to someone who's really into metal, I learn about bands I've never heard of before. And I like to take some sort of, you know, self pride in that I'm open to a lot of things. you know, I will listen to, just in metal alone, I will listen to things as quote unquote, you know, mainstream as Metallica. They are my number one favorite band of all time. You know, even when they're not good, I still love them. It's just what it is. To, you know, stuff that's, you know, more, you know, has more electronic influence and has more of a, symphonic metal to doom metal to sludgy metal to, you know, death metal and deathcore is something that's I'm really getting pulled into a bit. One of my favorite bands that are new is called Orbit Culture, and they are very much like, they kind of straddle that line where they have those really low growling aggressive vocals, but he also sings, and he sings like And Justice for All era James Hetfield, which is like catnip to most of us, you know. He's got that snarl to him, and there's kind a lot of melody to the music.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I totally get though your the entry point being for Cookie Monster vocals being kind of just difficult, because that was me for a very long time.
Yeah,
that was me for a very long time, and it took bands like some symphonic metal bands, because most symphonic metal bands, at least for in the early 2010s, you would have the operatic female singer.
Yeah.
And you'd have the male vocalist who does the low growly,
right,
you know, aggressive stuff. So you would be kind of like spoon fed it a little bit, so you can kind of used to it and all that.
Yeah.
And then eventually I just ended up really just being drawn to some of that stuff, even trying to do it myself and things like that. And so, yeah, there's definitely stuff like, you mentioned before, Our Mutual Bud, Brian Cirilla, some of the stuff.
Like, Cirilla just laughs at like whatever I consider metal, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because, you know, it was fairly recently he messaged me and he's like, I'm listening to the first three Metallica albums for the first time ever. I'm like, you've never listened to them? And I realized like that just, he was already like, neck deep into like Cattle Decapitation and and stuff like that. And Cannibal Corpse and all that. So I'm like, all right, cool. But yeah, there's definitely that, you know, that wide range. This is also what I love about comics, because we have metal and comics. They can be anything we want it to be.
Well, you know, that reminds me, Brian and I used to do a book together called The Anchor.
Yeah.
We would put a soundtrack in the back of every one of them, and I would put like the stuff I thought was heavy, and then Brian would jump in with whatever, like, you know, like child murder soundtracks he had.
Whatever bands with, you know, song names you have to like censor out.
Yes. Yeah. They all like have Incinerator or Decapitator or
some sort of side.
Yeah.
Like,
that's what made me feel like the oldest of anything in my life to date was when we gave our soundtrack recommendations.
Well, did you ever get into Static X since you were into ministry?
No.
Okay. No, they're not your thing? Okay.
Yeah. No, I mean, not like I'm against it or anything. Okay. It just wasn't.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I, you know, not that they are like ministry, but they have that electronic industrial component. And there is this screaming, but it's more...
No, I've heard it. It's just, grabbed me.
What else was I going to say? Did you ever like the... did you like Rob Halford's industrial project?
Two, oh, yeah. I believe it's Fight? For sure.
Which one was
that? Yeah. I think...
I which one was the industrial one?
Two.
Okay.
Yeah. I think when it was just TWO, that stuff he did with... Nine Inch Nails Kid. That's like one of my favorite of his songs, period. Is like the single that came off of that record.
Nice. Well, I will give one recommendation just based on, you know, is the band Gojira.
Okay. I will try them.
I would definitely try their Magma album. That's the one that got me into them, because they earlier in their catalog, they definitely have a lot more of the guttural, like low vocals, but there's something about his vocals in the Magma album. It's much more melodic. It's much more singing. Mm-hmm. And even then, like when he is screaming, it's not I'm affecting my voice to be you know, scary guy. It's I'm screaming because I have to scream right now.
He's not trying to.
There's like a feeling behind it.
Right.
You know, that
he's not like
that I really connected to.
He's not like the executioner in like a JC's haunted house.
Yeah.
Grumbly voice.
It's not, you know, George Corpse Grinder from Cannibal Corpse just, you know, just goes into that monotone, you know, thing. There's definitely a dynamic to it. And their music's really good. It's groovy. Their songs aren't like ridiculously long. And a lot of the riffs and grooves, the drummer is probably one of the best metal drummers out there right now, just because he has a lot of, he brings a lot of just like really funky jazz kind of influences the stuff he does. And I'm a big fanboy for them. They're like my number two band of all time. And they quickly rose to that setting from that Magma album in 2016.
If it's your number two, then I will check them out.
Yeah, Gojira, Magma. I can't recommend it enough. Well, what about comics? What comics have you been digging lately?
Oh, I still read comics, but I'm also like hopelessly behind on all my comics. Like,
That's a given. That's a given. With anybody.
Like, I'm still not done with Immortal Hulk. I like the example I always give people is I started reading Starman when it was over.
Yeah.
Like when the last issue came out, I was like, okay, now I'm going to start reading it. But I just, I know I'm biased because I just work with Tom King, but, that Helen of Windhorn book is really something else. It's really pretty incredible. I'm also, in anticipation of the second volume, I'm rereading My Favorite Thing is Monsters, which is really just like kind of a singular. It's every once in a while, somebody will come out with something. You're like, where did this person come from? They were like at home honing their skills for like 20 years. And then they just like unleashed their masterpiece on the world. And then this is a weird story, but when Harlan Ellison died, I bought his estate auction. I bought his collection of Thunder Agents comics from the 60s. Okay. So I'm going through and reading all the Thunder Agents books, most of which I've read because I wrote Thunder Agents back in the day. So I had to read up on him, but I didn't go from like page one, you know, A to Z, page one to the end.
Yeah.
And I'm going through that right now, reading Harlan's copies. So that's
nice.
A lot of my reading right now.
I don't have an extensive collection at all. I have maybe 1,200 books from growing up. I mean, I had more when I was younger, but I've gotten rid of a lot of them. You know, a lot of my purchasing quantity was the quarter bins, all the Extreme Studios stuff and all the Image stuff that was just like quickly dumped into those cheap bins that I've either torn up or gotten rid of or whatever, or just, you know, withered away. But I was recently transporting them into a hard shell case, as opposed to like the little flimsy
boxes. That's what I need. Yeah.
And then I'm like, you know, I'm going to start, you know, going through things I want to keep, things I don't want to have, because, you know, I just don't have the space for it. And, you know, I'm not going to sit down and reread so much of this stuff. You know, no offense to whether I enjoyed it or not at the time. It's just the reality of the situation. And I just found myself just like wanting to sit down and read up all of X-Men 2099 again.
Right.
And all of, you know, because that was like, you know, for me, that was like my book that I feel like people don't talk about this book enough. It was so good. And all that. And, you know, the mid-90s X-Men era, which was like, again, you know, my generation's main cultural touchstone, I guess, considering how we're all way too excited for that animated show to be coming back this year.
It really is mind-boggling to me.
Yeah. I still can't believe they're actually doing that, but I'm like, all right, I'm excited for it. I guess I got to start rewatching it again.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if it's just that's the biggest thing for me, like, in terms of what's going on in the industry right now, is to just watch these kind of waves of nostalgia come through that I wasn't a part of.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
like, I'm too old for Turtles. Like, I just missed Turtles by, like, in G.I. Joe by, like, 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I'm too old for them. But it's heartening to see people like beyond nostalgia, like hang on to their like their love for their genuine enthusiasm for those things, and to like express how it shaped their creativity by, you know, using that creativity to reinterpret those characters. And that's the same thing I'm doing when I'm like, you know, working on Batman or Spider-Man or whatever. It's like, those are the things that turned me on when I was a kid. So it's natural for me to like sort of express at least some of my creative energy that way. And like mm-hmm. the perfect example for me is Daniel Warren Johnson's Transformers book. Like yeah. I could care less about Transformers. Like that's like, I'm too old for that. So it doesn't mean anything to me, but I have like all the respect in the world for Daniel, and to see like him, like really get into his groove on that thing and like really bust out all of his creative chops, I can connect mm-hmm. with that, you know? So
yeah,
I try not to, a lot of old guys I know write things off if it wasn't part of their youthful experience. And that's something I try to fight against. Like, okay, so maybe I wasn't into Turtles, but this creator working on it is, you know, intriguing to me, so I'm going to check it out. Same thing with Thundercats, same thing with Transformers, all that stuff. So it's sort of like exercise. You have to like actively try not to become a curmudgeon. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah. Well, no, I understand it a bit of both ways. You know, I'm 41, so I'm seeing, you know, up and coming creators in their early 20s talking about things that I'm like, that was past my time already.
Right.
And you know, people who's like, this is my first comic. I'm like, that came out in 2004. I'm like,
right.
Oh my God. That was 20 years ago, you know, and then just this things like that. And, but on the flip side of it too, like I've tried to like, the best example I can think of is, a few years ago, Jeff Parker and Mark Laming, they did King's Watch.
Yeah.
I think it was through Dynamite.
Yeah.
And I give absolute zero shit about any of those characters.
Right.
But I like Jeff. I like Mark.
Yeah.
I think they're both great. And I gave it a shot and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the same thing like you. You're like, I don't care about Transformers, but I like the creator. Let me see what they're doing with it. And it was fun. And I was so glad that I had it there to read and enjoy and develop some sort of, you know, affinity for the characters. Like my only real touchstone for any of those characters was the Phantom movie with Billy Zane. And that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's my relationship with comics in general though, is like, I'm not following characters at all. I'm following creators. And like, if you had told me that when I was 13, like if you said, hey, 40 years from now, you're not going to subscribe to Spider-Man, I'd be like, you're insane. Or you're not going to read every issue of X-Men. I would think that was crazy. But as you grow, your tastes change and you start to recognize what you loved about those things in the first place were what the creators were bringing to it. Yeah. And I'd rather follow those creators and see what they have to say next. You know, and sometimes that takes them out of superheroes altogether. And and I was lucky that I was a teenager in a time when like the indie explosion was really taking place. And so you got to see all these people that up to that point would have been consigned to working for Marvel or DC the rest of their life doing their own thing. And that was really exciting to see. And it sort of led me to a larger love affair with comics in general instead of the superheroes.
Yeah, you know, obviously I came after that. I started reading comics, I think like a year after Image hit. Mm-hmm. So I was there like right when everything was like at its most ridiculous in terms of like speculation. Sure. But even then, it was at 93, 94.
Yeah.
Even then there was such a deep love from whatever I would read or talk to people or see of that indie boom, that it definitely like put something in me to where it's like, okay, well, these are just as valid as Wolverine, you know,
right.
this, this black and white independently made comic, I can enjoy this just as much as, you know, Maximum Carnage or whatever. And, you know, I, you know, though I've, you know, eventually went away from comics and art for a while, when I came back to it, I realized like that's more what I was drawn to. And just getting to know other creators and stuff like that, like I mainly read independent comics. I mainly read my friends' books, and I'm super happy about that because I have a lot of really talented friends who make really, really awesome books. And, you know, I can't, you know, I try to dip my toes into the mainstream stuff here and there because it's interesting. Like when New 50, you know, even though it's been 10 years now,
plus
the New 52 happened, you know, I went all in. You know, I started reading, you know, I was never a DC guy, and I tried it. And, you know, I think that's what really cemented my, I'm a creator. I want to follow creators, not necessarily characters. And, you know, so I think that's, you know, everyone has their taste. Some people were like, I could care less the name of the person who's doing my Spider-Man as long as it's my Spider-Man. Like,
yeah,
that's cool.
I mean, and hey, you know, more power to them. As long as they're, as long as they're buying the books, I'm okay. But yeah, it's,
you know, buy what you like. That's it. Buy what you like. And, you know,
it's so wild to me to meet people like that at shows, though, who think you're retired because you hadn't worked at Marvel for 10 years, you know, you've been working at Image or DC all that time. And they don't know what you've been up to because all they care about is Marvel, you know. And that's, I mean, come to this art form however you want. I'm not going to judge it. It's just, if you were like that into it, I would think the logical next step would be to follow creators and not characters, you know.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And hopefully more people start to see that, especially these days. I can't, you know, I listen to a few podcasts. You know, my buddy Patrick Bauer, he owns Challengers Comics in Chicago. He has a great podcast where they talk about their business and all that. And, you know, it's interesting to see where things are going and stuff like that. So, you know, I think at some point, the most pessimistic part of me is just like Marvel DCs are just going to be feeding whatever media they're going to be doing. And sure, there'll be breakout things from people who are getting a chance to do something, but more often than not, it's always going to be reset to match the movies or whatever. So, you know, I'd rather spend my time reading cool, fun books like, you know, Skeeters from Kelly Williams and Bob France and Kevin Cuff, or, you know, anything Scott Brian Wilson puts out, or, you know, anything Matt Lisniewski puts out and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And yeah, but, you know, like you said, you can't read comic, you can't like read comics wrong. Like if you enjoy it and you buy it, great.
I mean, that's, to me, that's the coolest thing about the landscape now, is it's really, we're sort of in the depths of this like narrow casting era of comics. Like everybody can find their comic now, but because everybody can find their comic now, nothing is going to be huge, huge, huge the way it was. When I was a kid, like I wasn't particularly into Conan, but I bought Conan every month because it was the comic that was out, and I wanted to read comics. And
what Marvel had, what, maybe 20 books?
Well, it varies, but what I'm saying is like now you can credibly be a comic book fan and never read superhero comics at all, never read North American comics at all. Never read manga. You can you can do all those things and call yourself a comic book fan because there's a ton of material out there that is just like so specialized or so narrowly focused that you can get all your needs met by a handful of books now instead of having to like take everything in like when I was a kid. And I think that's cool. I think it may like prevent the next like big breakout hit from ever truly going wide, but it's sort of what's happening to music now too. Like, you know, everything's in its own camp.
It's, you know, what was end stage capitalism, I guess.
You can find your people. That's what's happening now.
Yeah.
You can find your people.
Yeah. 100%. And that's my favorite thing about comics and music is I can find the stuff I like and people are making it, or I can make something and people can like it and hopefully it's something they've been looking for.
Right.
And things like that. So, and that's what, you know, that's where my interests lie now these days with, you know, whatever I make, I'm just doing it because that's what I want to do. And I'm hoping people enjoy it. And as long as it doesn't cost me money to do it, I'm going to be doing it.
That's really the,
I probably will still anyway.
I mean, once your thinking gets beyond that, when you start strategizing about what's, you know, what's going to succeed and what's not, that's like the beginning of your death as a creator.
When you're like, it's not fun.
You try to craft a hit, you're like, you're almost like developing a split personality. You're walking out of your own body as a creator instead of trying to make the thing that you want to see or read. And some people are lucky in that the things they want to see and read resonate with a lot of people and become hits. And some people, they just don't. And that's how it is. And I think I'm in this second camp, which is like sometimes things resonate and sometimes they don't. But I can't let chasing the things that break wide be my lodestone. It has to be me in the middle making books that I care about. You know, otherwise it'll start to, I don't know, maybe people will catch on, maybe they won't. But if I like start chasing hits, I will, like I said, I'll be walking further away from my own creative body. And that sounds like a recipe for disaster to me.
It is. It's, you know, I'm firmly like an independent creator. I've never done work for a big company or anything like that. But even when I've tried to like, what's my next thing? And I try to like think about it too analytically, as opposed to like, just what do I feel like doing?
Yeah.
You know, it sucks the fun out of it. It sucks the passion out of it. And it just becomes, you know,
it'll become a job.
Entering numbers on a spreadsheet, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, no shade to anyone who loves entering numbers on spreadsheets. Good for you. But it's the type of thing where it's like, you know, I want to do my own thing. I'm in a position in my life to where I can just do my own thing. I don't have to worry about it being a major hit or nothing. Again, as long as it's not costing me money, to do this, I'm going to keep doing it as long as I can. And you know, when Steve and I were first, you know, developing Evie and the Helsings and all that, you know, originally Steve had envisioned it to be a much more comedic book, much more of like kind of like the first Buffy movie, almost like just very, very, very comedy heavy with this, I think his original pitch was like Buffy meets Spinal Tap kind of thing. But you know, in talking about the characters and developing it, you know, and Steve and I, you know, we wear our hearts on our sleeves. We're sappy guys. And we just kind of fell in love with the characters and we're like, well, we can't like all these other more serious things came up with the book and all that. Right. So like we were more attracted to the drama of a lot of it as opposed to, you know, the silly parts or the humor parts or whatever like that. So, though I think, if I get my way, Steve and I will be introducing at least some of that and some other things, but anyway, but yeah, we're following what we wanted to do. Cause if we thought, oh, we'll make a horror comedy book and you know, it'll be great. People will love it. And we'd like, you know, who knows? One of the best examples I think is, Ryan Brown.
Oh yeah.
And you know, he's got his astronauts, like, yeah, the Kickstarters were like just astronomical on these things. And then Image picks it up and it doesn't sell. He does a collection, gangbusters. And now all of a sudden, you know, they got 8 billion genies, this huge deal with Amazon, you know, well-deserved. Ryan's a great dude, great creator, as is Charles Soule and all that. But it's just one of those things. They did what they wanted to do. And
yeah. He got there by
being
himself.
Sometimes it worked for him and sometimes it didn't.
Yeah. And he got there by being himself. And if he had like a lid agent whispering in his ear, they would say, don't make Blasphemous.
Yeah. You know, yeah, exactly.
Don't do that. They would.
Yeah.
But because he did that and because he did God Hates Astronauts, like I think he's like one of the funniest people in comics, period. Like his comics are the funniest. like right up there with Kate Beaton, in my opinion. And it's because he's himself, like, you know, from hanging out with him, that's Ryan, you know?
Yeah. My favorite thing to say about Ryan is, the first time any one of us really met him, was, Challengers was holding the 24-hour comic book day where you would sit down and a bunch of us would just stink up a comic shop trying to draw 24 pages in a day.
By the way.
And, you know, Ryan showed up or whatever, and he drew this comic, and we're like, where the fuck did this guy come from? Like, this is hilarious. Like, what is this? And then, like, we're reading God Hates. It's just like one of those things where it's like, he just blew in on a wind from Michigan.
Right.
Just kind of like immediately, like, just like took over everything. And it's just like, but again, you know, he's a super great guy. And he busts his ass, and I'm glad to have the success. He's gotten the success he's had.
He deserves it
for that. And, you know, on that topic, you know, we have some questions from the social medias. Let's jump right into one of them. And is from Austin Hamblin.
Oh, no.
Who are some up and coming creators people should be on the lookout for?
I think young Austin Hamblin is a writer to watch out for. No, I know Austin, anyone in the Midwest comic scene is sort of probably run across Austin. And he's like Ryan. He's like this guy that's doing like his own thing. And it's just like a matter of time before it like clicks with the right people and sort of spins out into its own like big thing. But I'm always watching, like, I think, like, despite Twitter being like a cesspool, and Blue Sky less of a cesspool, but the best thing about all those places is you can catch people as they're growing as artists, and like watch them go from, oh, this person's not there yet, but they're interesting, and then see that in 6 months they're incredible. You know?
Yeah.
Like Danny Earls is a great example of that. He's somebody who's like, oh, this guy's like, he's got promise. And then like a year later, he's everywhere, you know?
Yeah.
And you can see that, Laura Helsby is that way too. Like a lot of people don't know Laura yet, but they have a really interesting, interesting style. That's like, I can see it's like embryonic still. But I know like it's like 5 months from becoming incredible, you know? And I think that's great I think that's a great thing about Twitter. And it used to be you have to like go places like the Pencil Jack forums or whatever to like see people
webbing.
Or DeviantArt or whatever. And now it's a little more democratized. And also like the power of the retweets is pretty amazing. Like you can retweet somebody and like if the right editor or publisher sees it, they'll like get work from it. And so as much bad stuff comes from Twitter, I think it's all worth it because of like the art sharing opportunities that come up from it.
Well, I think with Twitter especially, there was such an ingrained foundation from the comics community in there that even though it is a cesspool now, it's still got plenty of people who are just excited about comics and sharing art and doing those things. Blue Sky's trying to get there, but it doesn't quite have that
critical mass yet.
I can't speak for like, you know, the engagement levels, because I've never had a consistent level of any low or high of engagement levels with anything on either platform. But yeah, but it's definitely thing like, well, the Danny Earls thing, I came across him when I think Gail Simone like was like, why isn't this guy hired yet?
Yeah. I mean, I saw him before that, but
I'm sure
you're going to be amazing. And he was amazing. Yeah. He became more amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and, for myself, I see, guys like Kyler Klotfelter.
Oh yeah.
I think he just needs to be put in the game.
It's just a lucky break here or there that he's waiting for.
Yeah. You know, and there's plenty of great writers.
It's hard to communicate that to people because like, you want to think it's all hard work and you want to think it's all, talent, but even super talented people and hardworking people need a break. Yeah. And like the talent and the hard work are there to shore up the opportunity you're given, and they make you ready for that mm-hmm. opportunity, but you can't make those opportunities happen. You just got to be ready. And Kyler's definitely a case where he's like, just like a tiny hair's breadth away from making it.
Yeah, exactly. He recently had someone shared a flash image he did doing like the Akira slide with just, running or whatever.
I know what you're talking about.
And, that started a whole new thing of like, people just coming to him. Kyler's a great dude. And I really hope it's just like that baby's breath away of just.
Yeah, I think it is.
Taken off. Like you said, this, no matter how talented you are, you need that. Sometimes you just need that little break. My favorite example of that is a few years ago, a book came out called Ghost Fleet.
Yeah.
By Donnie Cates and Daniel Warren Johnson.
And they were like not known then. Neither one of them were known.
And they didn't even get to finish it.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be a 12-issue series. They didn't even get to finish it. They had to like do the 6th issue digitally. And because it wouldn't sell. And then less than 2 years later, that book probably, if they came together on a book, it probably would have been the number one
book. Oh, number for sure. Book in for sure. I have a story about Daniel like that where I tried to get him. I wrote a short story at DC, and I'm not going to tell you which one because I don't want any sort of judgment on the people I did work on. Mm-hmm. But I tried to get him as the artist, and he was already feeling like he only wanted to draw his own stuff. And he goes, but I'll do it with you. And DC was like, what the hell is this? Like, we can't print this. And I even said to my editor, I'm like, in 6 months, you won't be able to hire him. You know, in 6 months, he'll be too big for you. And that's the way it was. Like 6 months later. I mean, they did hire him to do his own thing, to write and draw his own stuff. But like, they were scared of him at first, and they just weren't. They didn't have their antenna up for what was to come.
People take note. Just listen to Phil. Just listen to Phil.
For real. I'm always right.
He knows. There you go. Next one's from the aforementioned Kelly Williams. No questions. He just wants to say hi.
Hi, Kelly. I didn't see him. We always run into each other at in Wichita, and he wasn't there last year, but his stuff's really, like you said, Skeeters looks really great. And
That's completely his wheelhouse. And, Kelly's been a great friend to me because he's definitely sent stuff my way. Like one of the books I'm working on now was something he was going to be working on, but he just didn't have time for. And now that's what I'm doing. But, I even got a chance to work from his layouts and stuff, which is really fun because Kelly and I, you don't think, oh yeah, those guys mesh together, but it was really fun kind of just like, seeing how he's approaching things. And then it's definitely changed me, I think, for the better, at least with that book, just, embracing a bit more of the, just the great expression he gives everybody and stuff like that.
Everything from Kelly definitely feels like organic, hand-hewn comics. Everything's got that sort of like organic itchiness to it that is perfect for like horror comics.
Yeah. And especially something like Skeeters, which is like the the best 80s, splatterfest you never saw. Like it is, I totally just hear synth lines playing, John Carpenter type synth lines playing in the background when I'm reading that book. And my favorite thing about it is when people actually print Kelly's, watercolors and they don't overly saturate it or contrast it, and you can see the brush strokes and you can see this stuff. And Kelly's great. And another person I think, He's on the list of people where it's like, if I win the lotto, like I'm hiring him to draw stuff for me.
Oh, same. Sure. I would write a book for him in a heartbeat.
Next one is from good old Land Pitts. He wants to know if I know your story about The Fugitive.
Oh, well, I don't know if that's I think the
it may
story
not be appropriate.
My wife and I conceived our child after viewing The Fugitive.
Okay.
Is that, I think that's what he wants me to say. Because we, I don't know what we did. Like, I have this like freakish memory for meals. Like, I remember mm-hmm. like where I was. I remember what other people had if we were at a dinner together. And like, I also remember every theater I've ever, like every movie, I know what theater I saw it in. And okay. I know we were trying to conceive.
Mm-hmm.
We started trying to conceive the night of that we saw The Fugitive, and it worked. I guess I think that's a story. If that's not the story, I really revealed a little too much. But if that is the story, yeah. that's what I think he wants me to tell you.
Well, thanks, Lan. Now we all know.
Yeah. Now everyone has this, like, everyone has to have a mental image of me having sex. Sorry, world.
Next question is from, sorry if I mispronounce your last name, Phil Ubing, U-E-B-B-I-N-G, Phil Ubing.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to know, what is your most recent favorite metal album or band, if specific album is too narrow?
Yeah, I don't know. I like it. Like I said, it's hard for me to say. I think like the last metal album I bought was, well, do you guys count? See, I don't even know with you people. Is Queens of the Stone Age a metal band to you?
I mean, some people would say no. I would say yes.
Or
just because
Baroness?
Just the stuff you hear on the radio is like their most commercial stuff.
Yeah, but like,
if you go into the albums, it gets pretty nasty. Like,
it's not their fault for writing a hit, you know?
No. I think they definitely fall into I think desert metal or desert rock people call it.
It's because he's good looking, that's why.
Yeah. I think there's enough fuzz, there's enough just random fury and screaming and stuff. Like, I think it falls enough into
that. I bought a Mastodon record recently. I bought a Baroness record recently.
Okay. Well, yeah, those are firmly in the metal camps.
So. But right now I'm completely enthralled by like post rock now. So mm-hmm. like I can listen to Explosions in the Sky all day, you know, or Godspeed You Black Emperor. I can listen to that stuff all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, there's definitely the purists out there who are like, you know, this is metal and this isn't, but like, there's so many subgenres these days and it's enough. Like, if, you know, I don't know where I would draw my line for metal. It's just by feeling.
Yeah, for sure.
And even then, it's a subjective thing, you know.
And you see the same sort of thing in like in hip hop too. Like, it just gets so chopped up. Like, people from different scenes don't think the other scene is legit, and that's the way but I guess that speaks to the passion people have about the genre. Like, but anytime it makes you sort of insular, it's, I think, a waste of time. Like, I feel that way about comics. Yeah. Like, you could be so into like one kind of comic or one style of comic that like you close yourself off to like really cool stuff happening, you know, outside of the genre you like, you know, like at any time I go into a comic shop, I'm buying stuff from Fantagraphics. I'm buying manga. I'm buying Marvel, DC. I'm buying the mini comics I see on the counter before I check out, you know, whatever's there, because the comics I loved when I was a kid trained me to love comics, not Green Lantern, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 100%. Our last social media question is from good old Kirk at Big Five Army. He wants to know, did you collect art before entering comics as a pro? And do you collect comics on anywhere near the same level as you do art?
I have a huge comic collection. I could start a retail store right now on the back issues I have. And I still buy a lot of comics. And I want to say I started buying art at almost the exact time I started getting work in comics. But that was super young. Everyone should know. That was like at a time it was during the Black and White explosion when the Turtles came out.
Yeah.
And so like I was still in college and I was not ready to be working, but there were so many really terrible publishers that needed art. And so I got hired when I was not ready. And I started working in comics, and also the CBG was out then. And for the people that don't know, that's the Comics Buyer's Guide, which was sort of like both the industry trade and a fan, sort of a fan magazine pre-Wizard.
Yeah.
That came out every week. It was a newspaper. And in the back, they used to run ads for original art. And you could buy original art without seeing it. And yeah, that's what I did. I bought a page without seeing it for like $35. And it was it was a Ron Wilson Marvel 2-in-1 page. And then it was just so enchanting to me. It was seemed like comic collecting plus. You know, it was like deeper version of comic book collecting. And then I bought another, I bought a Jack Kirby page from the back of the CBG. And then when I started getting work from Marvel and DC and doing conventions and making money at conventions, it like the math there seemed really, really sweet to me, because like, oh, I can sell like five of my pages and go get one Wally Wood page, you know, or I could sell two of my pages and go get, you know, whatever. So that's when I really started getting into it, was when I started doing the con circuit.
Okay. Is it, is that Ron Wilson page? Is that something you still have?
Oh, sure. I've never sold a, well, I have sold art. I've sold two pieces of art out of the almost 600 pieces I own. I've sold two. One of them paid for my daughter's wedding. It was a Frank Miller Daredevil page. And one of them I really was just hard up for cash. But I've traded pages away, but outside of that, I haven't sold a page. So if I bought it, I still own it for the most part.
Oh, okay. Okay, because I was going to ask if there's any pages that you let go or traded that you either regretted or like felt like, no, I got the better end of this deal for sure.
I feel like I've always got the better end of the deal. I still miss those pages, though, you know. I mean, that's a sickness, I think. But like this poor guy, he's a really talented storyboard artist in Hollywood. And I owned a Toth Batman sketch and he really, really wanted it. And I was like, I really don't want to sell this. It's like, you rarely see Toth draw Batman. I'm not going to get rid of this. And he came back and he said, how about I give you X dollars, which was a fair price for it. And I will give you this Mike Mignola Hellboy page. And I was like, I can't really do that. And then he kept bumping the number until it was probably four times what the page was worth.
Jeez.
Plus the Hellboy page. And I was like, I can't say no to that. So I let it go. So yeah, I'm not, it wasn't equitable. I feel bad about it. Well, not totally bad, but I do miss that Batman sketch, you know, still I think about it.
But you know, on the flip side though, I mean, clearly he was somebody who was like willing to, you know, just had such a deep need for it himself that he was willing to go that crazy for it. You know.
Also, I have like 12 other toasts, so I'm okay.
Yeah. Okay. You'll be okay. You have enough. You have quite a few toasts then. you also collect sketches and commissions and stuff like that, correct?
Yeah.
Is that something you, is the feeling collecting art up like pages the same as getting commissions?
No, I'd rather have
two different itches.
I'd rather have a page because a lot of the times I'll have a, well, for one thing, I'm keyed into storytelling. So storytelling is important. Like if I'd been thinking about this as like a lucrative hobby when I was younger, I would have been buying terrible covers. You know, like when I was in my 20s and 30s, I'd been buying bad covers because covers are worth more. But I would rather have like an interesting page to me. And also certain pages have like a resonance to me as a reader. Like the pages I will never get rid of are, like I own a John Byrne page from Marvel Team Up that I bought while I was staying with my grandpa and grandma one summer, you know? And so like, I can see that page and I'm like right back to that time when I stayed at my grandpa and grandma's over a 4th of July holiday, you know? I have a Swamp Thing page that I remember the first time I saw it when I was a kid. Like, I remember where I read that page, and like, to own that page, to be the only person that can own that page, is like kind of like close to sort of magic to me, you know?
Yeah. I'm trying to remember the first time I ever saw like original comic art, and it was at this hotel convention near Chicago. And the first like original art pages I ever saw in person were Steve Scroyce's Age of Apocalypse pages. I think, what was the book he did? X-Man. Mm-hmm. And
I feel that was the first time I realized three pages of X-Man once.
And I think they're selling them. I think at the time they were selling them for like $100 each or something.
Yeah. And that probably seemed crazy at the time.
Yeah. And I'm like, you know, but I was just like so enamored with like, it was the first time I realized like, oh, they draw bigger.
Yeah.
Oh, they, you know, and all these things. And I was just so flabbergasted with it. And eventually the guy told me like, I have to like leave because I was just like staring at it for too long. But, you know, was there any pages? Cause you know, especially older art pages and stuff, like, you know, you, there's so much work on them, even they have like, you know, notes on the side.
I love that stuff.
You know, Zip-a-tone and stuff like that. Is there any page that you have that you kind of like, you discovered something that you wanted to learn how to do, or you just kind of, or just kind of blew your mind a little bit of like how they did something?
What's really cool is I own a couple of, well, there's two things that stand out to me. One, I own a Wally Wood page from the Outer Space Spirit for that short period at the end of the Spirit when Wally Wood took over the art chores. And there's a page that got, I own a page that was heavily redacted because the bad guy was deemed too close to being Hitler. So like at the last minute, they tried to make him into like a South American despot instead of Hitler.
Okay.
And so I threw it on the light box, and I could see all the places they'd whited out and all the dialogue they'd changed to make him not Hitler, which was really cool. But I think maybe the most instructive thing is I own a couple of, Frank Miller roughs from Sin City, from The Big Fat Kill. And Sin City sort of represents to a lot of Frank Miller fans, this sort of like dividing line when he started becoming more stark, more reductionist in his style, more minimalist. But in those roughs, you can still, and I own a Dark Knight Strikes Again page like this too. It's a rough as well. You can see him drawing every last detail of like the mechanisms of a gun before turning it into a silhouette, you know? Wow. And I have a Dark Knight page like that too, where you can see Batman, you can see every, like he's roughed out every bit of Batman's anatomy and Batman's form. And then the final page, it's the black cape. That's all you see. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a silhouette basically. But Frank still works through that stuff, so it's right. You know, so
yeah.
To the untrained eye, it looks like Frank is drawing less. He's not. He's choosing to present less of his drawing. And that was really instructive to me.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's one of my favorite things whenever I see original art, which, you know, as someone who, you know, primarily, at least with pages, you know, works digitally these days, I do kind of miss, you know, just seeing a lot of that stuff happen and all that. Because, you know, people do have their preliminaries and their roughs and they share it and all that. But just like seeing all like just the paper getting worn down and like little patches put in and stuff like that. There's definitely that
like just, every Kirby page I own has like a coffee ring on it where he set his mug of coffee in the margin.
just stuff like that that I miss. And you know, again, even though I work primarily on my iPad now, you know, I still want to like eventually, hopefully one day, get back to just at least doing some stuff on a board.
You have to be like Stegman and like recognize when something has resale value. You do it on the paper.
I did that, but with the second issue of Even the Helsings, like it's the first issue, we had people asking like, oh, is there original art? Because there was no original art tier for the Kickstarter. I'm like,
by the way, that's almost digital. My favorite tier of any Kickstarter is the original art tier.
And I'm like, no, there's no. So then I'm thinking like, well, maybe for the next issue, you know, I'll do a couple pages. And I did one page. It was the one splash page in the book of Evie staking a vampire or whatever. It was a lot of fun to do. I loved having it. No one bought it, but it was still fun for me to do and all that.
You'll want to keep it.
And I ended
up
giving it to our editor because he was such a huge help with the campaign anyway, as a thank you. But it's definitely, it's like, you know, that's definitely on my mind though. Like, okay, this is a pretty significant page. Like, and definitely want to do that. But, you know, for myself, strictly speaking, like my life right now is like, I can't really set up my board and work because my work time is so scattered throughout the day.
I remember that time.
But once, you know, once my youngest is in like full-time kindergarten this fall, I'll actually have like a good solid chunk in my day where there's, you know, no kids. So I can pull out the board. I can pull out the nib. I can safely pull these things out.
Your whole world will come into bloom again.
Yeah. Yeah. And so hopefully I'll be able to do some things like that. Cause I have other projects I want to do that I definitely want to just do like ink on paper for, but you know, you're as our mutual bud Ramon Villalobos likes to say, you're old school.
Yes.
You know, you're pencil paper. Did you ever flirt with like doing digital stuff or you're just like,
like I used to do a lot of experimental comics when I was like much younger and there was a lot of multimedia stuff involved in those and collage and xerography and stuff like that. So it seemed like doing stuff with the computer seemed like really natural. Like Dave McKean's a big hero of mine and seeing how he made that leap to digital stuff was enticing to me. But there's two things going on here. One is I always want to have paper. I always want to have a piece of art at the end. Well, maybe there's three things. I love like the tactile feel of paper. Like I have to get into a mess and like get out of it to feel like I've made a drawing. And I like not being able to undo things. You know, I like having to like fight my way out of a mistake. And also the third thing is like, I don't know if you've noticed this as you've gotten older, but your free time, it's just eaten away.
Yeah.
And like the idea of me taking off like 3 weeks to learn Clip Studio or something like, I can't take 3 weeks off. I got work to do, you know?
No.
I know it would make me faster. And I know it would open up new, like, new aesthetic aspects of my work that I haven't considered yet. Mm-hmm. But I don't have the time to learn it right now. You know what I mean?
No, I totally get it. You know, I flirted with digital with like, I had like the original like little cheap, you know, just on the desk pen and tablet thing.
Yeah,
not a screen. And then I had a real cheap Yanova whatever screen that barely worked, but it was good enough to like do corrections and stuff on and stuff like that. And then I got one of these Huion screens, which is like a good budget thing compared to a Wacom. And that screen was fine, but the pens were always really jank, you know. Always were like the barrier for everything. And then when 2020 came, you know, I just decided to like just, you know, follow Mike Norton's, you know, method, what he did when he was trying to go to digital, just pick something and do it. Just do one project digitally, get it done. And, you know, so I, you know, got my iPad and I said, hey, who wants to do some short stories for real cheap? And then that just kind of like went going from there. And, you know, I went through a lot of stuff, you know, mentally to like do all the art and all that, but it really opened up a lot for me when I found the right brush and the right settings that felt like it was when I was using a manual tool. Now, when I go back to do like commissions and sketches and stuff on paper, there's definitely, you know, the relearning curve a little bit, you know. I find like with digital, I do a lot of like, I'll switch my pen, my brush to an eraser, so I can just like use the same brush strokes, but like take away the blacks and do stuff like that and carve it away. Not as easy to do when you're
it's hard.
At least like, I don't have like, yeah.
I use that technique myself. Like I want to draw back into dark areas with white. And it's something like my inkers and I have like gone back and forth about like how to do that. And some like Andy Parks does it in Photoshop and Eric Gapster does it by hand. Like you'll actually like physically use white ink and draw back into the black areas where I indicate it. And it's not as easy as what you're talking about, but
not, you know, especially since, you know, I'm fairly comfortable with a brush pen. I'm pretty comfortable with a nib, an actual brush. My hands are too shaky. Like I just don't have the steadiness that's required. And that helps a lot. You know, the digital thing helps out a lot with that too, but you know, I've definitely been guilty of the trying to like rotate my paper or zoom in on my paper.
Yeah.
You know, at first I see people talk about that. I'm like, they're just having a silly joke or whatever. And then you do it enough times, you're like, Jesus, what's wrong with me?
You've been assimilated.
Yeah. So, but you know, I for me, I feel like it was worth it just because of just how my work time was set up, because I can go bring my iPad wherever I got
to
go.
Whatever,
and get stuff done.
Whatever it takes to get you to make comics is kosher.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I don't look down on anybody's work methods at all.
I am interested to see like what Phil Hester looks like with digital tools. Like just being able to just go full ham on it.
I can tell
Although
you right
I totally
now,
get your point.
It would become even less commercial.
But, you know, maybe less commercial, but I think most of us will probably love it more. Or
we'll
love
see.
It. One day, right? One day.
Yeah.
So I don't want to keep you too long, but is there anything right now that you want to talk about, you're working on, that you want to plug? You've got such a laundry list of this, like, amazing books under your belt. And
I have a bunch of stuff that I can't talk about. But right now, I think on the stands right now, I think the new issue of Green Arrow is still my issue. The one that I wrote through. I mean, didn't write. The one that I drew and the cover that I penciled in ink.
Yeah.
So I think that's still number 8, Green Arrow number 8. And outside of that, there's, like I said, a bunch of there. I have a, oh, no, I can't say that. Anyway,
should have asked you before I asked you to come on, like, oh, is there something particularly you want to promote? Like, I can't talk about anything. That's okay.
Yeah.
Like, but that's fine. That's fine. You know,
like I have like a thing I've been working on for like 6 months that nobody knows about. And then like a really special, awesome thing that will be announced pretty soon. And then, a mini series with a great writer that everybody knows, that I can't talk about again. Oh, I know what I can talk about. I did a short story for DC's April Fool's book.
Okay.
With Joshua Fialkov. We reunited. Oh, okay. I reunited with Fialkov, and it's a detective chimp story.
Oh, nice.
Which I think people enjoy.
You know what? Is there a character you haven't tackled yet that you really like?
Yes. Yeah. Like everybody knows it. I love Ragman. And I haven't got to work on Ragman. I like sneak him into cameos and backgrounds all the time, but I never got to work on him directly. And I also love the Doom Patrol, especially Robot Man. And I'd love to work on him. I'd like to get back to Marvel, and I love the Fantastic Four. I love all their like weird monster characters, Man Thing, It, the Living Colossus, the zombie, you know, all those characters. If it's weird, I like it. Wood God, you know.
Perfect, perfect. I have one last question, and I'll let you go to enjoy the rest of your evening. And that is, you know, you have a very distinct style, and you know, you have, you know, your inkers. You have Eric Gapster, fantastic artist in his own right. Some Kind of Super is a book my kids have and love. And Andy Parks, obviously. Is there an inker, you know, past or present that you're like, I really want to see what they look like over me?
Yeah. Well, I had that dream and it came true.
Oh, okay.
I really wanted to, like, I kept telling Andy and Eric the whole time we were working together, the only inker that I would ever leave them for was Klaus Janson. And I did, like a year and a half or 2 years ago, I did a half an issue of Crossover, Donny Cates' Crossover book.
Yeah, yeah.
That Kirkman wrote. And Kirkman wrote this story about Negan coming to life and killing him.
Mm-hmm.
And Eric was in a deadline crunch on Sword of Super. And okay. So I was like, I was just asking some friends, I'm like, who do you think would be like available to ink me? And Sean Crystal, I go, somebody sort of like Klaus. And Sean Crystal was like, well, why don't you just ask Klaus? And I was like, am I allowed to do that? And and we did, and it was awesome. Like, I got to see, like, Klaus was like one of the first inkers I could ever recognize as an inker, like, mm-hmm. outside of pencil art. Yeah. And so it was like very intimidating, but also very satisfying to like get to work with him on at least 10 pages worth of stuff. But if I'm allowed to like go back through time, boy, it's tough, because like a lot of the inkers from that, like from the distant past that I really admire, were also great pencilers in their own right. And a lot of them, I think, would not cotton to my style. Mm-hmm. I think they would be sort of feel compelled to fix it. But of modern inkers, I would love to see my stuff handled by Steve Lealoa and Bill Reinhold, Chicago guy, Bill Reinhold. I think Bill's like one of the best inkers ever. You can see him handle somebody as off the wall as Steve Ditko, mm-hmm. and then somebody as realistic as like Dougie Braithwaite.
Yeah.
And yeah. He can connect with both of those styles and enhance them both without changing them, which is like mm-hmm. kind of a miracle. And yeah, it's also because he's a really great artist in his own right. But
yeah,
I think he's
definitely an unsung hero.
Yeah. I think he's superb.
Steve Lealoa,
Steve Lealoa is
like
a top three. Like Gene Colan, I think, is probably the hardest guy ever to ink in comics. And mm-hmm. I think Steve is like a top two or three Gene Colan inker.
Awesome. Yeah. Klaus Janson was definitely the first inker I ever noticed was like on somebody, you know, and Tom Palmer was also like one of the first inkers I really noticed, just because how he just made everything softer, I guess, or more.
Yeah, rounded. Tom makes he made everything more organic.
Yeah.
And naturalistic. I think, well, organic's not the right word. Naturalistic's the word.
Yeah.
Like the light sources all seem natural and the tones all seem natural and cohesive. And Tom's one of those people who's, when he inks a job, it looks just as good in black and white as it does in color, which is mm-hmm. a really tough thing to pull off. And he did it.
And, you know, maybe a bit of a hot take, but I always preferred him over Klaus on JR Jr. And.
Oh, Tom Palmer over Klaus?
Yeah. Oh, over, JR Jr. instead of, not that it's a wide gap between the two and by any means whatsoever, you know, but definitely like if I had to pick a preference, I think he just edges out. For me,
I think Klaus reinforces JR Jr.'s strengths a little bit better. Mm-hmm. I think he picks up on like, and maybe that that naturalism that Tom brings to stuff is like a good counterpoint to Romita Jr.'s sort of like abstraction that he throws into his work.
Yeah.
But Klaus, I think, bolsters so much of Romita's sensibilities that I can't, I like, I'll always have Klaus way ahead on, yeah. on Romita.
You know, the closest thing I can liken to is like, is asking me like, oh, Don, what do you love more, pizza or tacos? Like, well, I love tacos more, but I'm not going to say no to fucking pizza. Like, you know,
taco pizza is the way to roll.
You know, it's, the both are great. And, yeah, but, yeah. So awesome. Awesome. Well, Phil, thank you so much for all your time. I really appreciate
Thanks,
it. I'd love to have you back on before too long. When hopefully
when I have something I can talk about.
We have more things you can talk about. Maybe, you know, I need to start like mixing and matching guests and getting, you know, some other people on here so no one's stuck talking to me for the whole time. But again, yeah, it's been a blast getting to talk to you for a bit. And yeah, now's the time. Let everybody know where they can find you on social media as if they don't know already.
Yeah, I'm on both Twitter and Blue Sky as Phil Hester. And then Austin Hamblin, the guy we were talking about earlier, he runs my, I'm not on Facebook myself, but he runs a Facebook page and you can get a hold, and he puts news up there and art. Okay. And also you can get a hold of me through that Facebook page. He'll relay it to me.
Awesome. Awesome. All right. Well, thanks again, Phil.
Thank you, Don.